From Saturday the 4th to Sunday the 5th of May, Reveil will embark on its 11th loop around the sun. Reveil is a collaborative sound and radio project presented by the SoundCap Cooperative that circles the Earth on live audio streams at daybreak. Reveil will be mixed from a hub at Stavehill Ecological Park in South London and stations at Tartu, Sunshine Coast, Cagna, and additional locations to be announced. You can listen online on Resonance Extra, Waveform, and other participating stations. For more information, please visit soundted.org/Reveil.
Shirley, Lego that gungu cat, you chat too mocking fudge. Lego rhythm and make sure run. Rhythm? Run on rhythm. Run rhythm. Dig me rhythm one time. Thank you. every man. Sing along, Babylon. Woo! Work it up. Dig it up. Dig it up.
We'll be right back. Mix up.
Hey!
Zukunft ist auch schon vorbei. Computergehirne fehlerfrei. Herz schlagen in der gleichen Frequenz. Maßgesteuert in die Dekadenz. Stunden, Sekunden digital. Menschenwissen ist universal. Dein Kopf gefüllt mit Fakten und Daten. Funktionen der Menschen, Automaten. Illusionen im Neonlicht. Ein Laserstrahl fällt auf dein Gesicht. Leben sterben, vorausprogrammiert. Kein Mensch mehr ohne Strom funktioniert. Überlastung, Terror, Alarm. Ein Vorschuss legt das Denken lahm. Magnetbandspulen bleiben stehen. Die Welt hört auf, sich um sich selbst zu drehen. Albtraum, Technik. Albtraum, Technik. Technik. Albtraum, Technik.
Kanat sesi tutulan bu kimin yası? Dön de bir bak memleketim, dön de bir bak memleketim. Uyudun kan uykusu. Gecemizde kanat sesi tutulan bu kimin yası? Gecemizde kanat sesi tutulan bu kimin yası? Dön de bir bak memleketim. Uyudun kan uykusu. Duydu kimse, ne bir aman diledik. Kahvenin ortasında, kahvenin ortasında sevdamızı biledik. Ne bir ah duydu kimse, ne bir aman diledik. Ne bir ah duydu kimse, ne bir aman diledik. Kahvenin ortasında sevdamızı biledik. Sanmaz asideyim, sevdalı bir yolcu sayın. gün ortası kara yere, gün ortası kara yere, düşürmeyin yüzü koyun. Bir uslanmaz asi deyin, sevdalı bir yolcu sayın. Bir uslanmaz asi deyin, sevdalı bir yolcu sayın. Gün ortası kara yere, düşürmeyin yüzü koyun.
She retrieved her coat from him and hung it up. While he'd been holding it, he had seemed entirely taken up with this task and oblivious to anything else. Without it, he seemed a little lost and naked, and was forced to stir himself back into life. He turned his big, heavy eyes back on Richard. "Richard," he said, "I read your piece in Fathom on music and..." "Fractal landscape," said Richard shortly. He didn't want to talk to Michael, and he certainly didn't want to get drawn into a conversation about Michael's wretched magazine, or rather, the magazine that used to be Michael's. That was the precise aspect of the conversation that Richard didn't want to get drawn into. Yes, very interesting, of course," said Michael in his silky, over-rounded voice. "Mountain shapes and tree shapes and all sorts of things. Recycled algae. Recursive algorithms. Yes, of course, very interesting, but so wrong, so terribly wrong. For the magazine, I mean. It is, after all, an arts review. I would never have allowed such a thing, of course. Ross has utterly ruined it. Utterly. He'll have to go. Have to. He has no sensibilities and is a thief." "He's not a thief, Wednesday. That's absolutely absurd," snapped Richard, instantly getting drawn into it in spite of his resolution not to. "He had nothing to do with your getting the push whatsoever. That was your own silly fault, and you..." There was a sharp intake of breath. "Richard," said Michael in his softest, quietest voice. Arguing with him was like getting tangled in parachute silk. "I think you do not understand how important..." "Michael," said Susan, gently but firmly, holding open the door. Michael Wenton Weeks nodded faintly and seemed to deflate. "Your book," Susan added, holding out to him a small and elderly volume on the ecclesiastical architecture of Kent. He took it, murmured some slight thanks, looked about him for a moment as if he'd suddenly realized something rather odd, then gathered himself together, nodded farewell, and left. Richard didn't appreciate quite how tense he had become till Michael left and he was suddenly able to relax. He'd always resented the indulgent soft spot that Susan had for Michael, even if she did try to disguise it by being terribly rude to him all the time, perhaps even because of that. "Susan, what can I say?" he started lamely. "You could say ouch for a start. You didn't even give me that satisfaction when I hit you, and I thought I did it rather hard. God, it's freezing in here. What's that window doing wide open?" She went over to shut it. "I told you, that's how I got in," said Richard. He sounded sufficiently as if he meant it to make her look around at him in surprise. "Really," he said, "like in the chocolate ads, only I forgot the box of chocolates." He shrugged sheepishly. She stared at him in amazement. "What on earth possessed you to do that?" she said. She stuck her head out of the window and looked down. "You could have got killed," she said, turning back to him. "Well, yes," he said. "It just seemed the only way to, I don't know." He ran at himself. "You took your key back, remember?" "Yes, I got fed up with you coming and raiding my larder when you couldn't be bothered to do your own shopping. Richard, you really climbed up this wall?" "Well, I wanted to be here when you got in." She shook her head in bewilderment. "It would have been a great deal better if you'd been here when I went out. Is that why you're wearing those filthy old clothes?" "Yes. You don't think I went to dinner at St. Sed's like this?" "Well, I no longer know what you consider to be rational behaviour." She sighed and fished about in the small drawer. "Here," she said, "if it's going to save your life," and handed him a couple of keys on a ring. "I'm too tired to be angry any more. An evening of being lobbied by Michael has taken it out of me." "Well, I'll never understand why you put up with him," said Richard, going to fetch the coffee. "I know you don't like him, but he's very sweet and can be charming in his sad kind of way. Usually it's very relaxing to be with someone who's so self-absorbed, because it doesn't make any demands on you. But he's obsessed with the idea that I can do something about his magazine. I can't, of course. Life doesn't work like that. I do feel sorry for him, though." "I don't. He's had it very, very easy all his life. He still has it very, very easy. He's just had his toy taken away from him, that's all. It's hardly unjust, is it?" "It's not a matter of whether it's just or not. I feel sorry for him because he's unhappy." Well, of course he's unhappy. Al Ross has turned Fathom into a really sharp, intelligent magazine that everyone suddenly wants to read. It was just a bumbling shambles before. His only real function was to let Michael have lunch and toady about with whoever he liked on the pretext that maybe they might like to write a little something. He hardly ever got an actual issue out. The whole thing was a sham. He pampered himself with it. I really don't find that charming or engaging. I'm sorry, I'm going on about it, and I didn't mean to. Susan shrugged uneasily. I think you overreact, she said, though I think I will have to steer clear of him if he's going to keep on at me to do something I simply can't do. It's too exhausting. Anyway, listen, I'm glad you had a lousy evening. I want to talk about what we were going to do this weekend. Ah, said Richard. Well, oh, said Susan, I better just check the messages first. She walked past him to the telephone answering machine, played the first few seconds of Gordon's message, and then suddenly ejected the cassette. I can't be bothered, she said, giving it to him. Could you just give this straight to Susan at the office tomorrow, save her a trip? If there's anything important on it, she can tell me. Richard blinked and said, yes, and pocketed the tape, tingling with the shock of the reprieve. Anyway, the weekend, said Susan, sitting down on the sofa. Richard wiped his hand over his brow. Susan, I'm afraid I've got to work, she said. Nicola's sick, and I'm going to have to dep for her at the Wigmore on Friday week. There's some Vivaldi and some Mozart I don't know too well, so that means a lot of extra practice this weekend, I'm afraid. Sorry. Well, in fact, said Richard, I have to work as well. He sat down by her. I know. Gordon keeps on at me to nag you. I wish he wouldn't. It's none of my business, and it puts me in an invidious position. I'm tired of being pressurized by people, Richard. At least you don't do that. She took a sip of her coffee. But I'm sure, she added, that there's some kind of grey area between being pressurized and being completely forgotten about that I'd quite like to explore. Oh, give me a hug. He hugged her, feeling that he was monstrously and unworthily lucky. An hour later, he let himself out and discovered that Pizza Express was closed. Meanwhile, Michael Wenton Weeks made his way back to his home in Chelsea. As he sat in the back of the taxi, he watched the streets with a blank stare and tapped his fingers lightly against the window in a slow, thoughtful rhythm. Rap-tap-tap-a-rap-tap-a-rap-a-tap. He was one of those dangerous people who are soft, squidgy, and cow-like, provided they have what they want. And because he had always had what he wanted, and had seemed easily pleased with it, it had never occurred to anybody that he was anything other than soft, squidgy, and cow-like. You would have to push through a lot of soft, squidgy bits in order to find a bit that didn't give when you pushed it. That was the bit that all of the soft, squidgy bits were there to protect. Michael Wenton Weeks was the younger son of Lord Magna, publisher, newspaper owner, and overindulgent father, under whose protective umbrella it had pleased Michael to run his own little magazine at a magnificent loss. Lord Magna had presided over the gradual but dignified and well-respected decline of the publishing empire originally founded by his father, the first Lord Magna. Michael continued to tap his knuckles lightly on the glass. A rap-tap, a rap-a-tap. He remembered the appalling, terrible day when his father had electrocuted himself changing a plug, and his mother, took over the business. Not only took it over, but started running it with completely unexpected verve and determination. She examined the company with a very sharp eye as to how it was being run, or walked, as she put it, and eventually even got around to looking at the accounts of Michael's magazine. Tap, tap, tap. Now, Michael knew just enough about the business side of things to know what the figures ought to be, and he had simply assured his father that that was indeed what they were. Can't allow this job just to be a sinecure. You must see that, old fellow. You have to pay your way, or how would it look? How would it be? His father used to say. And Michael would nod seriously and start thinking out the figures for next month, or whenever it was he would next manage to get an issue out. His mother, on the other hand, was not so indulgent. Not by a lorry load. Michael usually referred to his mother as an old battle axe, but if she was fairly to compare to a battle axe, it would only be to an exquisitely crafted, beautifully balanced battle axe with an elegant minimum of fine engraving which stopped just short of its gleaming razored edge. One swipe from such an instrument, and you wouldn't even know you'd been hit until you tried to look at your watch a little later and discovered that your arm wasn't on. She had been waiting patiently, or at least with the appearance of patience, in the wings all this time, being the devoted wife, the doting but strict mother. Now someone had taken her, to switch metaphors for a moment, out of her scabbard, and everyone was running for cover, including Michael. It was her firm belief that Michael, whom she quietly adored, had been spoiled, in the fullest and worst sense of the word, and she was determined at this late stage to stop it. It didn't take her more than a few minutes to see that he had simply been making up the figures every month, and that the magazine was hemorrhaging money as Michael toyed with it, all the time running up huge lunch bills, taxi accounts, and staff costs that he would playfully set against fictitious taxes. The whole thing had simply got lost somewhere in the gargantuan accounts of Magna House. She had then summoned Michael to see her. Tap, tap, tap-a-rap-a-tap, tap-tap. "How do you want me to treat you?" she said. "As my son, or as the editor of one of my magazines? I'm happy to do either." "Your magazines? Well, I am your son, but I don't see..." "Right. Michael, I want you to look at these figures," she said, briskly, handing over a sheet of computer printout. "The ones on the left show the actual incomings and outgoings of Fathom. The ones on the right are your own figures. Does anything strike you about them?" "Mother, I can explain. I..." "Good," said Lady Magna sweetly. "I'm very glad of that." She took the piece of paper back. "Now, do you have any views on how the magazine should best be run in the future?" "Yes, absolutely. Very strong ones. I..." "Good," said Lady Magna with a bright smile. "Well, that's all perfectly satisfactory, then. Don't you want to hear..." "No, that's all right, dear. I'm just happy to know that you do have something to say on the matter to clear it all up. I'm sure the new owner of Fathom will be glad to listen to whatever it is." "What?" said a stunned Michael. "You mean you're actually selling Fathom?" "No, I mean I've already sold it. Didn't get much for it, I'm afraid. £1 plus a promise that you would be retained as the editor for the next 3 issues, and after that it's at the new owner's discretion." Michael stared, pop-eyed. "Well, come now," said his mother reasonably. "We could hardly continue under the present arrangement, could we? You always agreed with your father that the job should not be a sinecure for you, and since I would have a great deal of difficulty in either believing or resisting your stories, I thought I would hand the problem on to someone with whom you could have a more objective relationship. Now, I have another appointment, Michael."
"Well, but who have you sold it to?" spluttered Michael.
"Gordon Way."
"Gordon Way? But for heaven's sake, Mother, he's..."
"He's very anxious to be seen to patronise the arts, and I think I do mean patronise. I'm sure you'll get on splendidly, dear. Now, if you don't mind..." Michael stood his ground.
"I've never heard of anything so outrageous. I..."
"Do you know, that's exactly what Mr. Way said when I showed him these figures and then demanded that you be kept on as editor for 3 issues." Michael huffed and puffed and went red and wagged his finger, but could think of nothing more to say, except... "What difference would it have made to all this if I'd said, 'Treat me as the editor of one of your magazines?'" "Why, dear," said Lady Magna with her sweetest smile, "I would have called you Mr. Wenton Weeks, of course, and I wouldn't now be telling you to straighten your tie," she added, with a tiny little gesture under her chin. Rap, tap, tap, rap, tap, tap. "Number 17, was it, Gov?"
What?"
said Michael, shaking his head. "It was 17, you said, was it?" said the cab driver. "'Cause we're here."
Oh, yes,
thank you," said Michael. He climbed out and fumbled in his pocket for some money.
"Tap, tap, tap, eh?"
"What?" said Michael, handing over the fare. "Tap, tap, tap," said the cab driver, "all the bloody way here. Got something on your mind, eh, mate?"
"Mind your own bloody business," snapped Michael savagely.
"Oh, if you say so, mate. Just thought you might be going mad or something," said the cabbie, and drove off. Michael let himself into his house and walked through the cold hall to the dining room, turned on the overhead light, and poured himself a brandy from the decanter. He took off his coat, threw it across the large mahogany dining table, and pulled a chair over to the window, where he sat nursing his drink and his grievances. Tap, 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 he went on the window. He had sullenly remained as editor for the stipulated 3 issues, and was then, with little ceremony, let go. A new editor was found, a certain A.K. Ross, who was young, hungry, and ambitious, and he quickly turned the magazine into a resounding success. Michael, in the meantime, had been lost and naked. There was nothing else for him. He tapped on the window again and looked, as he frequently did, at the small table lamp that stood on the sill. It was a rather ugly, ordinary little lamp, and the only thing about it that regularly transfixed his attention was that this was the lamp that had electrocuted his father, and this was where he had been sitting. The old boy was such a fool with anything technical. Michael could just see him peering with profound concentration through his half-moons and sucking his moustache as he tried to unravel the arcane complexities of a 13-amp plug. He had, it seemed, plugged it back in the wall without first screwing the cover back on, and then tried to change the fuse in situ. From this he received the shock which had stilled his already dicky heart. Such a simple, simple error, thought Michael, such as anyone could have made, anyone, but the consequences of it were catastrophic. utterly catastrophic. His father's death, his own loss, the rise of the appalling Ross and his disastrously successful magazine, and tap, tap, tap. He looked at the window, at his own reflection, and at the dark shadows of the bushes on the other side of it. He looked again at the lamp. This was the very object, this the very place, and the error was such a simple one. Simple to make, simple to prevent. The only thing that separated him from that simple moment was the invisible barrier of the months that had passed in between. A sudden, odd calm descended on him, as if something inside him had suddenly been resolved. Tap, tap, tap. Fathom was his. It wasn't meant to be a success. It was his life. His life had been taken from him, and that demanded a response. Tap, tap, tap. Crack! He surprised himself by suddenly punching his hand through the window and cutting himself quite badly. Chapter 15. Some of the less pleasant aspects of being dead were beginning to creep up on Gordon Way as he stood in front of his cottage. It was, in fact, a rather large house by anybody else's standards, but he had always wanted to have a cottage in the country, and so when the time came for him finally to buy one, and he discovered that he had rather more money available than he had ever seriously believed he might own, he bought a large old rectory and called it a cottage, in spite of its 7 bedrooms and its 4 acres of dank Cambridgeshire land. This did little to endear him to people who only had cottages. But then, if Gordon Way had allowed his actions to be governed by what endeared him to other people, he wouldn't have been Gordon Way. He wasn't, of course, Gordon Way any longer. He was the ghost of Gordon Way. In his pocket, he had the ghosts of Gordon Way's keys. It was this realization that had stopped him for a moment in his invisible tracks. The idea of walking through walls, frankly, revolted him. It was something he had been trying strenuously to avoid all night. He had instead been fighting to grip and grapple with every object he touched, in order to render it, and thereby himself, substantial. To enter his house, his own house, by any means other than that of opening the front door and striding in a proprietorial manner, filled him with a hurtling sense of loss. He wished, as he stared at it, that the house was not such an extreme example of Victorian Gothic, and that the moonlight didn't play so coldly on its narrow gabled windows and its forbidding turrets. He had joked stupidly when he bought it that it looked as if it ought to be haunted, not realizing that one day it would be, or by whom. A chill of the spirit gripped him as he made his way silently up the driveway, lined by the looming shapes of yew trees that were far older than the rectory itself. It was a disturbing thought that anybody else might be scared walking up such a driveway on such a night, for fear of meeting something such as him. Behind a screen of yew trees off to his left stood the gloomy bulk of the old church, decaying now, only used in rotation with others in neighbouring villages, and presided over by a vicar who was usually breathless from bicycling there, and dispirited by the few who were waiting for him when he arrived. Behind the steeple of the church hung the cold eye of the moon. A glimpse of movement seemed suddenly to catch his eye, as if a figure had moved in the bushes near the house, but it was, he told himself, only his imagination, overwrought by the strain of being dead. What was there here that he could possibly be afraid of? He continued onwards, around the angle of the wing of the rectory, towards the front door, set deep within its gloomy porch, wreathed in ivy. He was suddenly startled to realise there was light coming from inside the house, electric light and also the dim flicker of firelight. It was a moment or two before he realised that he was, of course, expected that night, though hardly in his present form. Mrs. Bennett, the elderly housekeeper, would have been in to make the bed, light the fire, and leave out a light supper for him. The television, too, would be on, especially so that he could turn it off impatiently upon entering. His footsteps failed to crunch on the gravel as he approached. Though he knew that he must fail at the door, he nevertheless could not but go there first, to try if he could open it. And only then, hidden within the shadows of the porch, would he close his eyes and let himself slip ashamedly through it. He stepped up to the door and stopped. It was open. Just half an inch, but it was open. His spirit fluttered in fearful surprise. How could it be open? Mrs. Bennett was always so conscientious about such things. He stood uncertainly for a moment, and then with difficulty exerted himself against the door. Under the little pressure he could bring to bear on it, it swung slowly and unwillingly open, its hinges groaning in protest. He stepped through and slipped along the stone-flagged hallway. A wide staircase led up into the darkness, but the doors that led off from the hallway all stood closed. The nearest door led into the drawing room, in which the fire was burning, and from which he could hear the muted car chases of the late movie. He struggled futilely for a moment or two with its shiny brass doorknob, but was forced in the end to admit a humiliating defeat, and with a sudden rage flung himself straight at the door and through it. The room inside was a picture of pleasant domestic warmth. He staggered violently into it and was unable to stop himself, floating on through a small occasional table set with thick sandwiches and a thermos flask of hot coffee, through a large overstuffed armchair, into the fire, through the thick hot brickwork, and into the cold dark dining room beyond. The connecting door back into the sitting room was also closed. Gordon fingered it numbly, and then, submitting himself to the inevitable, braced himself and slid back through it calmly, gently, noticing for the first time the rich internal grain of the wood. The coziness of the room was almost too much for Gordon, and he wandered distractedly around it, unable to settle, letting the warm liveliness of the firelight play through him. Him it couldn't warm. What, he wondered, were ghosts supposed to do all night? He sat uneasily and watched the television. Soon, however, the car chases drifted peacefully to a close, and there was nothing left but grey snow and white noise, which he was unable to turn off. He found he'd sunk too far into the chair and confused himself with bits of it as he pushed and pulled himself up. He tried to amuse himself by standing in the middle of a table, but it did little to alleviate a mood that was sliding inexorably from despondency downwards. Perhaps he would sleep. Perhaps. He felt no tiredness or drowsiness, but just a deadly craving for oblivion. He passed back through the closed door and into the dark hallway, from which the wide, heavy stairs led to the large, gloomy bedrooms above. Up these, emptily, he trod. It was for nothing, he knew. If you cannot open the door to a bedroom, you cannot sleep in its bed. He slid himself through the door and lifted himself onto the bed, which he knew to be cold, though he could not feel it. The moon seemed unable to leave him alone and shone full on him as he lay there, wide-eyed and empty, unable now to remember what sleep was or how to do it. The horror of hollowness lay on him, the horror of lying ceaselessly and forever awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. He had nowhere to go, nothing to do when he got there, and no one he could go and wake up who wouldn't be utterly horrified to see him. The worst moment had been when he had seen Richard on the road, Richard's face frozen white in the windscreen. He saw again his face and that of the pale figure next to him. That had been the thing which had shaken out of him the lingering shred of warmth at the back of his mind which said that this was just a temporary problem. It seemed terrible in the night hours, but would be all right in the morning when he could see people and sort things out. He fingered the memory of the moment in his mind and could not let it go. He had seen Richard. And Richard, he knew, had seen him. It was not going to be all right. Usually when he felt this bad at night, he popped downstairs to see what was in the fridge, so he went now. It would be more cheerful than this moonlit bedroom. He would hang around the kitchen, going bump in the night. He slid down and partially through the banisters, wafted through the kitchen door without a second thought, and then devoted all his concentration and energy for about 5 minutes to getting the light switch on. That gave him a real sense of achievement, and he determined to celebrate with a beer. After a moment or two of repeatedly juggling and dropping a can of Foster's, he gave it up. He had not the slightest conception of how he could manage to open a ring pull, and besides, the stuff was all shaken up by now, and what was he going to do with the stuff, even if he could get it open? He didn't have a body to keep it in. He hurled the can away from him, and it scuttled off under a cupboard. He began to notice something about himself, which was the way in which his ability to grasp things seemed to grow and fade in a slow rhythm, as did his visibility. There was an irregularity in the rhythm, though, or perhaps it was just that sometimes the effects of it would be much more pronounced than at others. That, too, seemed to vary according to a slower rhythm. Just at that moment it seemed to him that his strength was on the increase. In a sudden fever of activity, he tried to see how many things in the kitchen he could move or use or somehow get to work. He pulled open cupboards, yanked out drawers, scattering cutlery on the floor. He got a brief whir out of the food processor. He knocked over the electric coffee grinder without getting it to work. He turned on the gas on the cooker hob, but then couldn't light it. He savaged a loaf of bread with a carving knife. He tried stuffing lumps of bread into his mouth, but they simply fell through his mouth to the floor. A mouse appeared, but scurried from the room, its coat electric with fear. Eventually, he stopped and sat on the kitchen table, emotionally exhausted but physically numb. How, he wondered, would people react to his death? Who would be most sorry to know that he had gone? For a while, there would be shock, then sadness. Then they would adjust, and he would be a fading memory as people got on with their own lives without him, thinking that he had gone on to wherever people go. That was a thought that filled him with the most icy dread. He had not gone. He was still here. He sat facing one cupboard that he hadn't managed to open yet because its handle was too stiff, and that annoyed him. He grappled awkwardly with a tin of tomatoes and then went over again to the large cupboard and attacked the handle with the tin. The door flew open, and his own missing, blood-stained body fell horribly forward out of it. Gordon hadn't realized up to this point that it was possible for a ghost to faint. He realized it now and did it. He was woken a couple of hours later by the sound of his gas cooker exploding. Chapter 16. The following morning, Richard woke up twice. The first time, he assumed he'd made a mistake and turned over for a fitful few minutes more. The second time, he sat up with a jolt, as the events of the previous night insisted themselves upon him. He went downstairs and had a moody and unsettled breakfast, during which nothing went right. He burnt the toast, spilt the coffee, and realized that though he'd meant to buy some more marmalade yesterday, he hadn't. He surveyed his feeble attempt at feeding himself and thought that maybe he could at least allow himself the time to take Susan out for an amazing meal tonight to make up for last night, if he could persuade her to come. There was a restaurant that Gordon had been enthusing about at great length and recommending that they try. Gordon was pretty good on restaurants. He certainly seemed to spend enough time in them. He sat and tapped his teeth with a pencil for a couple of minutes and then went up to his workroom and lugged a telephone directory out from under a pile of computer magazines. L'Esprit d'Escalier. He phoned the restaurant and tried to book a table, but when he said when he wanted it for, this seemed to cause a little amusement. "Ah, no, monsieur," said the maitre d', "I regret that it is impossible. At this moment it is necessary to make reservations at least 3 weeks in advance, pardon, monsieur." Richard marvelled at the idea that there were people who actually knew what they wanted to do 3 weeks in advance, thanked the maitre d' and rang off. Well, maybe a pizza again instead. This thought connected back to the appointment he had failed to keep last night, and after a moment, curiosity overcame him, and he reached for the phone book again. Gentlemen, gentles, gentry. There was no gently at all, not a single one. He found the other directories, except for the Esther Z book, which his cleaning lady continually threw away for reasons he had never yet fathomed. There was certainly no Chelly or anything like it. There was no Gently with a J, no Gently with a DG, no Gently with a DJ, no Gently with a DZ, nor anything remotely similar. He wondered about TJ Entley, TS Entley, or TZ Entley, and tried director inquiries, but they were out. He sat and tapped his teeth with the pencil again and watched his sofa slowly revolving on the screen of his computer. How very peculiar it had been that it had only been hours earlier that Reg had asked after Dirk with such urgency. If you really wanted to find someone, how would you set about it and what would you do? He tried phoning the police, but they were out too. Well, that was that. He had done all he could do for the moment short of hiring a private detective, and he had better ways of wasting his time and money. He would run into Dirk again, as he did every few years or so. He found it hard to believe that there were really such people, anyway, as private detectives. What sort of people were they? What did they look like? Where did they work? What sort of tie would you wear if you were a private detective? Presumably it would have to be exactly the sort of tie that people wouldn't expect private detectives to wear. Imagine having to sort out a problem like that when you just got up. Just out of curiosity as much as anything else, and because the only alternative was settling down to anthem coding, he found himself leafing through the yellow pages. Private detectives. See detective agencies. The words looked almost odd in such a solid and business-like context. He flipped back through the book. Dry cleaners, dog breeders, dental technicians, detective agencies. At that moment, the phone rang and he answered it, a little curtly. He didn't like being interrupted. "Something wrong, Richard?" "Oh, hi, Kate. Sorry, no, I was... my mind was elsewhere." Kate Anselm was another star programmer at Wayfair.